Good afternoon. The time is 1:32, and I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belt's Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Wednesday, March 27, 2024. Members present are Senator Merrick, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senators Bishop and Senator Rejection are excused today. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to recognize and welcome back our recording secretary, Lisa Denny, and our LAO moderator, Joseph Giesbrecht. Today we have three items on our agenda. First is Senate Bill 154, Bidder Preference for Military Career and Skill Programs. Senate Bill 239, Aid to Workforce Housing Development. And Senate Bill 257, Electric Utility Regulation. Our first bill up today is Senate Bill 154. We first heard the bill on March 4th when we heard a presentation of the bill and open public testimony. Today we have Caleb Callahan, staff to the Honorable Senator Bill Walkowski, here with us to give us a recap of the bill and answer any questions that may have come up since our last hearing. Mr. Callahan, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name for the record and begin your recap of the bill.
Thank you, Senators of the Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Caleb Callahan, staff to interning for Senator Walkowski. So this bill, SB 154, establishes a 2% bidder preference for military service members who are becoming veterans, and encouraging businesses to partner with these programs such as SkillBridge, to encourage businesses, encouraging businesses to partner with these programs so that we can get more procurement for veterans entering the civilian workforce.
Very good. It's a good common sense bill. Are there any questions from committee members or committee discussion? Seeing none, at this time, I will reopen public testimony on Senate Bill 154. Is there anyone in the House who wishes to testify? Is there anyone online? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Is there further committee discussion? Hearing and seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. I move to report Senate Bill 154, version 33-LS0545/Bravo, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, Senate Bill 154 moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for the next bill. back on the record at 138 in Belch Room 105. Next up, we have Senate Bill 239. We have here bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Forrest Dunbar, and his staff, James Holzenberg, to present the bill. Senator Dunbar, please put yourself on the record. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Forrest Dunbar, Senator from District J, and with me is my staffer, James Holzenberg. Unfortunately, as I was telling the chair before we began, our invited testifier is not able to come at this time today. So I'll just speak briefly about this bill and hopefully we can go through a sectional. So the genesis of this bill, which allows ADA to engage in financing for housing construction, was a conversation I had with Mr. Nolan Clauda from the University of Alaska, and he was going to be our testifier today. We were speaking this summer about ways to encourage housing construction in Alaska, and I'm sure I don't have to remind the folks on this body how critical it is to build more housing in this state. We've had dramatic increase in prices of housing, and it has become a drag, frankly, on our entire economy. And when I was the assembly representative to the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, we'd hear from companies very often that struggled to find housing for professionals they would recruit to bring up to Alaska. We've also heard challenges in rural Alaska with bringing in teachers and other public employees and with large-scale construction projects. So, for example, we have a lot of construction that's going to be happening in and around Nome in the coming years. And there is a legitimate question about where those folks are going to live while they're working there. ADA, of course, is the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. And in our conversations with them, it became clear that they agree that part of industrial development and building value-added export industries is having housing for workers to live in. In our research on this bill, we discovered from ADA that they actually did do housing construction and housing financing in the early 80s, but then there was a housing crash and they sort of have avoided it since then. So arguably, ADA could do this already. They could use their current resources to fund housing. However, we wanted to make it explicit, and my staff will go through a sectional about where we do that. Basically, it is not a mandate. We are saying, ADA, you can do this thing. You have the legal authority to finance housing construction. In particular, we highlighted multifamily workforce housing. Now, initially, we had it written more broadly, but in our discussions with the Bankers Association, they felt a bit uncomfortable with perhaps competing with ADA for certain kinds of loans, that ADA can offer at a lower rate. So we wanted to focus on the kind of housing that really isn't being built in Alaska right now. There is very few projects that are multifamily workforce housing right now. In fact, some of the only projects being built in Anchorage, at least, of course, Anchorage is where I can speak to, are financed by the Cook Inlet Housing Authority. We would like to have more private builders be able to build this kind of workforce housing, and we're hopeful that ADA can provide some financing mechanisms. We're not very prescriptive. We basically give them the right to do this, and we let them sort of figure out exactly what that might look like. We spoke with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. They are not opposed to this because, again, it sort of fits a niche that they don't really engage in. And we spoke with ADA, and they, of course, they were comfortable with it so long as we weren't mandating them to do anything, just sort of give them another option. So with that, Mr. Chair, I turn it over to my staffer to present the sectional.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Mr. Holzenberg, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is James Holzenberg, staff to Senator Forrest Dunbar. Starting the sectional, Section 1 adds a new subsection 7 to AS 448870, which states the purpose of the authority. We are now granting ADA the ability to facilitate the financing of the construction of new workforce housing units with 5 or more units. In Section 2, we add a new subsection 33 to AS 448880, which gives ability, this is sort of the more like explicit working part of the bill that just states that they will now have the legal ability to provide these means of financing and facilitating the financing of construction. In section three, this is just a brief conforming change that extends the definition of development projects that ADA can finance the creation and construction of. We include workforce housing facilities with 500 dwelling units, and we define what exactly those are in the new section J. And finally, section J just defines workforce housing as residential housing that costs the occupants less than 30% of the income of a household with 120% of the area median family income. This is determined by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. It's also commonly known as AMI, and that is calculated annually by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And that concludes the sectional. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions for the bill sponsor or staff? Seeing none. Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Also we have online for questions, Mark Davis, special counsel for ADA. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman, through the chair to Senator Dunbar. Have you talked to any private contractors that think they might take advantage of this program?
Thank you, Senator Merrick, through the chair. We had spoke with not a contractor, but a developer, and they were interested in doing this. Unfortunately, they don't build workforce, and so initially, the initial version of the bill was a broader definition of housing, not work, just workforce housing, and that was sort of a compromise that we reached with the Bankers Association. And so that person I was in conversation with probably wouldn't use this tool now. And we haven't found anybody yet who might want to, someone else. I remain hopeful, you know, and I'll say that, again, it was sort of something we had worked with the Bankers Association on. It's kind of this catch-22 where I understand why they don't want to compete with ADA and with these lower rates. On the other hand, this kind of housing really isn't getting built, and so we want to use the tools that we have. So the short answer to your question is not contractors. Had spoken with the developer, but they probably will no longer use this particular tool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very well. Well, thank you very much, Senator Dunbar. Did you have any closing comments you'd like to make about the bill?
No. I suppose, do you think we'll be able to hear public testimony today, Mr. Chair? Do you want to do that at a different date?
We had not noticed public testimony.
Oh, very well.
But if you had testifiers here in the room or online that specifically showed up to testify to this bill, we are flexible here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I don't believe we have anyone online. So that's fine. I was just double checking. I'll just say thank you very much for hearing this bill. And, you know, we are hopeful that given that ADA supports it, we will be able to give them this additional tool.
Very good. Thank you very much. At this time, we will set Senate Bill 239 aside, and we will take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. back on the record. It's 149 here in Belch Room 105. Senate Labor and Commerce will now take up Senate Bill 257, Electric Utility Regulation. We have bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Kathy Geisel, and her staff, Angela Rodell, to give a recap of the bill. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing the bill again. For the record, I'm Kathy Geisel. I have the honor of representing Senate District E, which is a major part of Anchorage, all the way down to Whittier. Senate Bill 257 establishes a rail belt transmission organization, which would oversee the function and dispatch of the lowest cost electrons across a grid, thereby lowering consumers' cost. It is a critically needed piece of legislation as we move toward more electrical, lower cost electrons, and it opens up the backbone transmission system wide open to independent power producers who are certainly expanding our renewable resource energy access, Mr. Chairman. So thank you for hearing the bill. My staff, Angela Rodell, will go through a sectional, each piece of the bill highlighting and open to questions, Mr. Chairman. I know there's a lot of folks reading the bill that are not sure what it is actually referring to. So we're hoping to clarify that. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm staff to Senator Kathy Geisel. I do have a presentation to help us walk through the sectional analysis of Senate Bill 257, as there is a lot of different moving parts, and this bill touches on various sections of existing statute. So starting with sections 1 and 2, Section 1 in particular amends Alaska Statute 4204-020A, and this is to clarify and update the qualifications of individuals nominated to serve as a commissioner for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. It does this by requiring at least 5 years of experience in addition to a degree in the field, in the associated degrees, so whether it's law, engineering, economics, finance, business. So it requires additional experience. Section 2 amends Alaska Statute 4205-381 by clarifying that the RCA may consider a diversity of energy supply, promotion of load growth, or enhanced energy reliability or security in determining if an electric utility's rate is just and reasonable. Current law requires them to just consider cost, and we want to make sure that they are able to consider additional factors if they so choose to weigh, and that goes to the reliability of the grid. Section 3.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, would you like Ms. Rodell to stop at the end of each slide for questions, or you'll simply stop us?
Thank you, Senator. I was just pondering that question myself. I think we'll, if the bill's long enough, I think if we go through questions as we go, that might be better. Okay. That being said, I have a question about Section 2. Is there a hierarchy of needs or preference that the RCA considers when they decide on a project or a rate, in this case, about whether or not that power is good power for a project or when creating a rate?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a really good question. Unfortunately, I don't have the answer. That'd be a really good question for the RCA, and we can send that question and follow up with the committee with their response.
Sure. I think as I understand it, they're looking at reliability, number one. They got to keep the lights on. And then they're looking at market, so like cost of what the power would be to produce, and then quality of that power, and other factors. So how would this help the RCA to make good decisions about permitting projects and creating rates while still keeping cost at the forefront for members, homeowners, businesses to have cheap power?
Mr. Chair, if I might, we do have, we invited Gwen Holdman.
Great.
And she may be able to answer those questions. It's not a question I'm prepared to answer for you today.
Okay, no problem. And that's totally fine.
Chairman Perkman, for the record, my name is Gwen Holdman. I represent the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. Thank you for that question. I think that's a really excellent observation. There are many times where the kinds of energy projects that we're developing at any one point in time may not be the lowest cost project at that moment. A really good example of that would be the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. At the time it was constructed, it was actually the most expensive power for the railroad grid. This is actually a large reason why it wound up being exempt from regulation. There was a real concern that would it be subject to regulation, that the Regulatory Commission would not approve that project because of the cost of delivered power at the time it was constructed. Today, it's essentially the lowest or one of the lowest forms of electric power on the grid. And so another change at that time could have been made to amend the way the RCA thinks about these. So we're not just taking into account the lowest cost of power today, but really taking a look at how we want our electric systems to look in the future in ways that best meet the needs of consumers, not only today, but tomorrow as well.
Okay. So if we could put a little bit more detail on that, are there projects out there right now or proposed projects that would benefit from this change as provided in Section 2?
Senator Bjorkman, I don't believe that this was written with the intention of benefiting any individual project. It's important to note that this is not specifically related to renewables or non-renewable sources of energy. One way that one could interpret diversity of supply would be to say, we're looking at more local energy sources that could displace declining supplies of Cook Inlet gas. That could include increasing the amount of coal that we might be using in the state, for example. That would be an example of looking at a more diverse supply of energy and taking that into account when we're making decisions about investments by individual utilities.
Very good. So more coal, more hydro, all that.
All of the above.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Rodell, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to Section 3. Section 3 makes improvements to the Electric Reliability Organization by repealing the requirement that an Electric Reliability Organization, or ERO, must develop integrated resource plans and adds the requirement that the ERO must participate in an integrated grid plan conducted by the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. It also adds the requirement that the ERO prioritize reliability and stability of the system served by the ERO while taking into account cost to the consumer.
Very good. I do have a question on this section as well. What is the difference between participating in an integrated grid plan and developing an integrated resource plan?
Mr. Chairman, I'll explain my understanding of this, but I think it's really important. The integrated grid plan takes into account sort of all the sections, operational management of the transmission system, of the grid system, taking into account all those pieces of it. The integrated resource plan was more than just the reliability standards. It also includes transmission, generation, and distribution. And so what this is doing is it's bifurcating that out, and it's telling the ERO that we want you to focus on the reliability standards, on making sure that everything coming in is reliable, that those standards, that there's consistent use from the generation, whereas the RTO is going to focus on an integrated grid plan. And I may have butchered that, so I'm going to look to the person, the expert to my left, to see just how badly I butchered that and have her add some additional clarification.
We're all learning today. That's okay.
Yeah.
Ms. Holdman.
Thank you. So an integrated resource plan typically focuses more on the generation assets of the system. And as the grid is evolving and as we're starting to use electric power in different ways, where there's an expectation that there's going to be more things like electric vehicles or heat pumps on the grid and on the system, this idea of taking a more holistic approach to planning is something that is being done in other markets. Hawaii would be a good example of that, where instead of just focusing on generation planning, on transmission planning separately, and then the utilities doing distribution planning, taking a more holistic approach across the entire system for the benefit of continuing to develop, upgrade that system to meet consumers' needs and keep prices contained for consumers across the system. As Angela correctly mentioned, it's sort of bifurcating this particular function away from this electric reliability organization where it currently sits, and it's placing this with this rail belt transmission organization. The ERO retains the functions of setting reliability standards and enforcing those, as well as interconnection standards for both utilities and independent power producers. So it still retains those two important functions, but it takes and moves planning to the transmission organization and redefines it as a more holistic effort.
Okay, thank you.
Moving on to Section 4. Section 4 amends Alaska Statute 4205-765A by clarifying that the responsibility of an ERO must be to develop, monitor, and enforce reliability standards, and it is the responsibility of an ERO to ensure that the stable operation of the interconnect bulk electric system served by an ERO, and specifically require coordination with the rail belt transmission organization when developing reliability standards that impact the RTO.
Okay.
Moving on to Section 5. Section 5 is a conforming section, so it repeals Alaska Statute 4205-771, which is the requirement that an ERO tariff include standards for non-discriminatory open access transmission and interconnection and standards for transmission system cost recovery. So because this is now moving over to the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, we are removing this from the ERO requirements so that there's not a conflict within the new statutes. Moving on to Section 6, Section 6 amends Alaska Statute 4205-772 by adding that a load-serving entity that would otherwise be exempt from regulation under this chapter shall adhere to the ERO's reliability standards, coordinate with the ERO, and, if applicable, coordinate with the Rail Belt Transmission Organization to integrate reliability standards into the load-serving entity's operational procedures.
Very good. And so this section and the chapter talking about being otherwise exempt, who is otherwise exempt? Is that going to be the RTO, ERO, who is otherwise exempt here under this section?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to look to Gwen to define the load-serving entity to make sure I don't butcher that definition, but it's my understanding a load-serving entity could be an IPP.
A load-serving entity is defined as a distribution usually a distribution utility that actually has customers. And I apologize because I don't have the bill in front of me. I'm a little bit lost on where we are in this, but I believe that this still relates to the ERO.
It does.
So this is still under the RCA regs, and
yes,
this relates to the ERO.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good.
You are correct on where this is.
Continue, please.
On Section 7, we're amending Alaska Statute 4205-785 to repeal D, which requires the RCA to adopt regulations addressing projects undertaken before integrated resource plan approval for an interconnected electric energy transmission network. So again, this is removing anything, because we're moving the integrated resource plan requirements from the ERO, and this is the ERO's section of statute. We're removing the requirement for the RCA to adopt regulations because they will not be submitting now an integrated resource plan. Moving on to Section 8, these again are some conforming administrative needs. So Section 8 amends Alaska Statute 4205-790 by adding that the definition of rail belt has the same meaning given to it in AS 4483-750, which is a section we're building in this statute. And rail belt transmission organization means the organization established by 4483-700. Section 9 amends Alaska Statute 4483-080, which is the section overseeing the Alaska Energy Authority, by adding to the powers of the Alaska Energy Authority the ability to carry out the duties and powers assigned under this new rail belt transmission organization language, as well as adding the ability to acquire battery energy storage systems by construction, purchase, gift, or lease.
I have a question. You mentioned other changes in the bill other than subsection 20 to section 9. What else is changing besides 20 section 9?
We are adding the requirement that they have the ability to carry out the duties and powers that will be assigned to them by under Alaska Statute 4483-700 through 750, which is what I'm going to get to in Section 10. Section 10 creates those areas of statute, which is the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. And so this is saying to the Alaska Energy Authority, under Alaska Energy Authority's statutes, that they have the ability to undertake these responsibilities.
I got you. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Yep. So Section 10 is the creation of the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. It starts off by amending Alaska Statute 4483 by adding a new subsection creating the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. 4483-700A establishes the RTO under the Alaska Energy Authority for the purpose of developing a backbone transmission system for the Rail Belt. B establishes the governance structure that provides for oversight of the RTO, creating a management committee that is composed of members representing each of the utilities, the executive director of the Alaska Energy Authority, and the chair of the ERO, and requires the RTO to establish a conflict resolution process and facilitates public participation in the operations of the RTO. Section C clarifies the RTO is subject to the jurisdiction of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and the RCA will adopt regulations as necessary, including defining by regulation the term backbone transmission asset.
Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if this is spelled out elsewhere. I just didn't see it. For the section you said, Section B, representatives from each of the rail belt utilities. Now, I think of the rail belt utilities as being four of them, but is that actually true? Are there additional rail belt utilities besides, you know, Chugach, Homer Electric, MEA, and Golden Valley?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, there is some question whether or not Seward Electric would be included in this, but that would be the only one that you're not mentioning. And then to your point about rail belt, has the definition already given to it in statute. So that'll help the RCA with some of that.
May I, Mr. Chair? Rail belt utility is, or rail belt is defined, but I do wonder, you would know better than me, if there are any small scale, like for example, we have a small, very small water district in Spinard that is technically a utility that is basically the size of like one neighborhood in Anchorage. Is there anything equivalent to that in the energy space? It's probably for Ms. Holdman. That's along the rail belt that you're aware of?
There are no other independent utilities that that have a load servicing area along the rail belt other than these five entities that have been mentioned so far. And there is not a reason to believe that a new one would be created in the future, although it's always possible. So, yeah.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. So it occurs to me, I think we had this discussion before, but the way this board is structured, Seward, which serves, what, 2,000, maybe 4,000 people, would have, and actually they maybe they have other outlying areas too, so a little bit more than that, but they would have the same sort of weight on the board as Chugach would, that serves several hundred thousand. Is that an issue?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, we don't believe that that's an issue. This is the idea of this management committee is inspired by the Bradley Lake Management Committee, and that load or customer base has not been an issue for the management of that over since 1987 that I'm aware of. So I don't believe that is an issue today.
Okay. And yeah, not trying to cast aspersions on Seward or their power utility. I'm sure they do great work. It's just an interesting, fact of this law that they will have the same voting authority as much, much larger utilities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. I have a question in regards to subsection B3 about facilitating public participation in the operations of the transmission organization. There's discussion around many parts of government, education, fire service, all kinds of stuff, about the separation between governance and operations. This particular sentence seems to blur those lines substantially by offering public participation in operations. Has there been any feedback from utilities regarding how this would look? Is there current public participation in the operations of the Bradley Project Agreement? How would that look? What's going on here?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that Bradley Lake does not have an avenue for public participation. And I have not received any comment from the utilities asking that this be removed or revised or concerns. So I'm not aware of any concerns surrounding this particular language. I think the idea behind this is to create some sort of mechanism for public comment given the number of people impacted by a rail belt transmission organization.
Ms. Holdman, do you have any sense of how public participation in operations for a transmission organization would work? What would the effect of that public participation be?
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. I would say that I think the desire here is to have as much transparency as possible. That's part of why this rail belt transmission organization would fall under RCA regulation, for example. And so my understanding is that there's a desire to have robust public participation in the process. I would say that the word facilitate public participation in the operations of the transmission organization could perhaps be improved upon somewhat.
Thank you. Yeah, I have had constituents reach out to me with concern about this line, and we'll have further conversations about that. But certainly as we kind of think about an RTO as being a tool of management to deliver massive amounts of electrons from Homer to Healy, and that being a management function, I think it's important to have a separation between a creation of a governance structure and standards and what it means to have an organization that is responsible for operating backbone transmission. Please continue, Ms. Rodell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Within Section 10, we next create Alaska Statute 4483.710, which sets out the powers and duties of the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. And these include managing backbone transmission assets, follow the reliability standards as established by the ERO, ensure safe, resilient, reliable, efficient, and economical operation and development of an integrated transmission system, preserve non-discriminatory open access, maintain capacity rights of legacy transmission owners, and perform integrated transmission planning. The RTO is also given the authority to purchase, lease, or acquire backbone transmission assets, enter into contracts, agreements, and partnerships that will enhance the safety, reliability, and efficiency of an integrated system for the rail belt. Section 44.83.720 creates a revenue mechanism. This is subject to the approval of the RCA, whereby the RTO shall hold and administer an open access transmission tariff, shall adopt a transmission cost recovery methodology that ensures the reliability and sufficient capacity of the integrated transmission to support and promote the economy. In addition, the cost recovery methodology must eliminate per unit wholesale transmission charges and pool backbone transmission costs and allocate these costs to end users. So this is the elimination of wheeling and pancaking, as you may have heard in other presentations.
Very good. I have a question. On the Kenai Peninsula, Homer Electric is planned to be islanded for a number of months, 4 to 5 months out of the year, for every year for quite a while. And this limits their ability to sell power off the peninsula if IPPs were to be sited there, or they would have excess generation running during those months. HEA cannot sell power or purchase power from other portions of the grid because they will essentially be unplugged from the rest of the grid. Is there any mechanism in the bill now to reduce tariffs, reduce cost recovery from the ERO, or otherwise compensate HEA members for them being disconnected and islanded for a third or more of the year for the next 10 years?
Mr. Chairman, I'll start, and maybe Gwen has additional comments. I think that's one of the reasons this bill is so important, quite honestly, is because it creates an organization that requires the utilities to come together and figure that out and put together a tariff request in front of the RCA that will acknowledge potentially that the issue you raise. Without this, there is no requirement on the part of any of the utilities to coordinate with HEA in that instance.
So, Senator Bjorkman, it's interesting to portray things that way, that Homer Electric Association or the Kenai would be islanded. I'm not certain that I fully understand that, because our most important asset, Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, is on the Kenai Peninsula. So the idea of disconnecting that asset from the rest of the grid so the rest of consumers at along the entire system wouldn't have access to that power doesn't really make sense. As I understand the system, what I believe may be occurring is that there's a bottleneck in the system, that it's fully committed to the movement of that power off the Kenai, which then prevents the use of that same asset to actually move power potentially the other direction. And so this is one of the things that is really important to recognize with this piece of legislation, the build-out of new assets to unconstrain these bottlenecks in the system is a really important complementary thing. And one of the most important ones is to unconstrain and have a second avenue of power flowing both on and off the Kenai Peninsula. That's one of the major components of this GRIP proposal that I'm sure that you have heard of, funding that the rail belt utilities in the state have managed to win, and that will require 50% match from non-federal funds.
Very good. One second, and I'll get to your question. As I understand how HEA has become islanded in the past, specifically with the Swan Lake fire in 2019 and the transmission line being down for some time, and then through the planned islanding due to upgrades in transmission that Chugach Electric is doing over the coming years, it's my understanding that Bradley Lake Power gets used on the peninsula, and that cheap power is still shared out among all of the utilities. However, HEA has to share those cost savings with all the utilities. So it is not that HEA financially benefits from being islanded, because then they get to use all of the Bradley Lake power. They have to share those savings with the other utilities based on the Bradley management agreement. And maybe Curtis Thayer or Brian Hickey or someone else could talk about that and how it works at a later hearing. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to sort of drill down on the rail, the RTO, and what it actually is or does in this section. I've heard sort of conflicting descriptions of this. So I guess my question is sort of, is the RTO a systems operator? In the sense that, will this RTO actually be dispatching power, or will it have the authority to dispatch power? Because I've heard it both ways. If this is intended to eventually be like something some of us saw in Iceland, where it's kind of got a central hub and power is flowing throughout the grid, and this organization is managing that, or will that stay with Chugach and with the various others who have their own kind of comm centers, or whatever the term is, their own centers for doing this. So that's my question. Is this going to be a systems operator or not?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, this will not be a systems operator.
Okay. So may I follow up, Mr. Chair? It is sort of interesting. So we've heard some advocates say that we need a systems operator. And so do we think in the future, maybe this is a question for Ms. Holdman, will we have a systems operator as well, and then we'll have the RRC and the RTO and the systems operator? Or can we have the utilities just do that on their own without the centralization that we saw in Iceland?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So as Angela correctly articulated, this does not include a systems operator element to it at this point in time. So this is a portion of what, in the case of Iceland with their regional transmission operator, what Landsnet does there. It does not include that dispatch of power that's still happening at the utility level at this point in time. It's my hope, personally, that the main advantage of having a system operator is to ensure economic dispatch, that the lowest cost source of power is being turned on first or next, and that energy is flowing to consumers across the system. It's my hope, by setting this structure in place and also eliminating wheeling, that there will be a natural movement toward a natural structure of economic dispatch along the grid, that the utilities will gravitate toward that. To some extent, that has also been mandated by the regulatory commission. So there's like a tight pool between MEA and CHUGACH, for example. So there's been some mandating through the RCA of economic dispatch. I believe that this structure should allow, through just natural market forces, to incentivize utilities to engage in economic dispatch of resources that are part of the entire system as a whole. If that doesn't happen in the future, this legislative body could decide to add additional duties to this RTO and make them both an RTO, or a transmission organization, and an integrated system operator, as is done in Iceland. That is an option. Or there could be the option to take other sorts of measures. I'm not certain that we need to do all of that at once. It's nice to sort of see when you take some steps, what happens, how the deck is reshuffled a little bit, how the utilities respond, and how the market operates within that construct.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I have another question, slightly different, having to do with the management of assets. And again, here I've sort of heard two different conflicting views, and I think I know what management means. Management doesn't necessarily mean ownership, right? And so these facilities would still be owned by the utilities, but perhaps managed by the RTO. But it sort of begs the question of, what does that actually mean when you maintain something like this? We have at the utilities, we have an existing workforce with CBAs in place. And so the question is the RTO envisioned, is it envisioned that the RTO or the AEA acting on the RTO's behalf would build up a workforce that would do repairs and maintenance and have to negotiate their own CBAs? Or would they manage in some way, but not sort of, I don't want to say infringe, but not take over that work from the utilities?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it's not the intent to have this organization take over, build up its own workforce, have AEA to build up its workforce. As I mentioned previously, the model that this is based off is the Bradley Lake management model. And in that case, the utilities are still responsible for the agreements to manage the assets. It's rather that the backbone transmission assets would now be managed collectively. So in other words, in your example, CHUGACH doesn't go off and decide on its own about backbone transmission assets, but rather those assets are discussed within the management framework of the RTO, and decisions are made about the management of those backbone assets.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So let's say we have an outage along that backbone asset, and it is in, let's say, physically MEA's territory. Is it envisioned that AEA, that owns the asset, would have workforce to go and repair that? Or is it thinking that there would be, through this RTO, MEA would perhaps repair it and then be compensated in some way?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, they will work out these details as the RTO comes together in formats. But I suspect, given conversations, it'll be the latter, where AEA will not have the staffing, will not be having teams of electricians to go out and do this, but rather MEA will go out, fix their assets, and pass along the costs, bring that to the RTO.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I add something to that?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, this is the way things are happening today. So the Alaska Energy Authority already owns about a third of the transmission assets, and they have no labor force that works on those. So they have agreements worked out with the local utilities for both the Alaska Intertie and the more recently purchased, SQQ line, SSQ line, that they worked out with those local utilities to conduct any repairs or maintenance that's needed. And those costs are generally fairly well, there can always be something that happens that's pretty significant, but for the most part, those regular O&M costs are fairly well understood and can be planned for and predicted. So.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know I talked about 720. I'm going to touch on 730, 740, and 750 just to make sure for the record that we've talked about those. So 730 requires that the Rail Belt Transmission Organization engage in integrated grid planning at least every 10 years, and the plan must use a whole system approach. 740 requires that the Rail Belt Transmission Organization identify existing backbone transmission assets and that the utilities will transfer management of those assets by July 1st, 2026. And finally, 4483750 defines backbone transmission system as the assets of the interconnected electric energy transmission network that serves the rail belt. It defines the commission as the RCA, defines interconnected electric energy transmission network as the same definition as that is currently in law and used for the ERO in 4205790, defines rail belt as the area of Alaska that ranges from the Kenai Peninsula to interior Alaska, connected by a common electric transmission backbone, and defines rail belt utility to mean a public utility certificated to operate in the rail belt, and defines transmission organization as the RTO established in this bill. Moving on to section 11, and this is these sections, the remaining sections are all final implementation. So section 11 repeals Alaska Statute 4205780 and 4205785B, which sets forth all the integrated resource planning and integrated resource planning tariffs that are currently in statute for the ERO, because all of that is being moved over to the RTO. Section 12 sets the directive for the Alaska Energy Authority and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to adopt all those necessary regulations to implement the changes made by this bill. Section 13 requires the Alaska Energy Authority to immediately begin an initial integrated grid plan and capital improvement program. Section 14 states that 12 and 13 will take effect immediately, and Section 15 is an effective date of July 1, 2024 for all other sections.
Very good.
And with that, if there are any further questions, we'd be happy to try and answer.
Well, this has been great. Thank you. Are there other questions from members of the committee? I have one other question. I think it is much needed that we have some qualifications for members of the RCA. I'm wondering, considering the size of the RRC board and the ponderous nature of their decision-making processes so far, I wonder if there's been consideration taken to changing qualifications to be on the ERO board that functions as RRC. Has anyone thought about doing any of that or having qualifications that might require a certain level of expertise in the creation of electrons, generation of electrons, to serve on the ERO board?
Mr. Chairman, we've not had anybody come and request that, but it's a conversation I guess we can continue to have.
Very good. Thank you. Nothing further. Senator Giesel, did you have any closing comments for today's hearing?
Mr. Chairman, again, thank you. For the record, this is Senator Kathy Giesel. Thank you again for hearing the bill. Thank you for these great questions. I think that we were able to clarify some of the misunderstandings in the bill. I know when the public reads the bill, they may not recognize the AS 41, 42, 43, whatever, referring to RCA, Alaska Energy Authority, or the TRO. And so I think this helped clarify some of that. So thank you for all those great questions. And your last question about the ERO qualifications, certainly that's an interesting idea to take a look at that. So, again, at the committee's pleasure, thanks for thinking about that.
You betcha. Well, thank you all. I appreciate today. Thanks for sticking around on a beautiful sunny day here in the nation's most beautiful capital city. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday, April 3rd. As there is no further business to come before Senate Labor and Commerce today, this meeting is adjourned at 2:34 p.m.